Pleasure to introduce our main speaker, Hector E. from Los Angeles.
Hello, everybody. My name is Hector, and I'm an alcoholic. Hey, how you doing? Before I forget, I'd like to thank Bob D. for asking me to speak. He came and spoke for us last Sunday at our meeting. He did a phenomenal job. I want to thank Kevin for being such a wonderful host and helping me so much to get here. My sponsee, Mike, who drove me here. And Rich for such a nice food and such a nice, friendly fellowship in his house. You know, these are the people who make AA. You know, I'm a secretary in my meeting, and we start at 10:30, but at 9 o'clock in the morning, I'm there an hour and a half earlier to make sure everything runs smoothly. Anyway, the last time I spoke here, you were in a different place. And this is bigger. Wow. And I'm going to tell you my story. Remember, whatever I said from the podium is just my experience and my opinion. Unfortunately, I happen to be very opinionated, and I may be wrong, but I'm never in doubt, okay? One of the wonderful things is, you know, we can all have different stories and different approaches, you know, to the program. But as long as we don't drink and work the program, we stay sober and we create happy, more wonderful lives. I want to tell you a little bit about my parents in Argentina. I was born in Argentina. My parents were, you know, foreigners, and they were illiterate. And they were very, very, very poor. You know, poor in this country, in the United States of America, is middle class all around the world. You guys don't know it. You know, had dirt floor and outhouse, or rotten piss on the floor, no running water. And they were very, very violent, my parents. And I'm not telling you this because it has anything to do with my drinking. I'm telling you this because when I finish my pitch, I'm going to tell you how I made amends with my parents and how I healed that relationship. You know, they were poor, my parents. They were illiterate. They dressed badly, and they smelled even worse. You see, we had no bathroom, so we showered maybe once a month. And they were very, very violent. But I didn't know I was an abused child until I came here to AA. You know, here they give you all these problems, you know. I thought everybody, you know, got chained to the sewing machine. My mother used to chain me to a sewing machine. It was nothing personal, really, you know. She also chained my kid sister and the dog. She was an equal opportunity chainer, you know what I mean? She disagreed with you, you know, and she said, I'll chain you, you know. It didn't bother me too much. You just sit there, count to dial, and daydream about masturbation, you know. Well, we didn't have cable TV in those days, you know, so. But what she did to really, really scare me is when I would do something mischievous, she would say, I'm not going to chase after you. You have to come to sleep. So when I was sound asleep at 1 o'clock in the morning, she would uncover me and beat me up with a shoe or a piece of wood. So I always slept totally covered because I didn't know what was coming. My father was more violent. When he got angry, he grabbed a knife or a gun, and we all run to the street because he's going to kill us, you know. So I didn't grow up to be a young man, you know, with a lot of self-esteem. And my first dream as a child was not to be president of Argentina, a doctor, or a movie star. My first dream as a child was to kill my daddy. What are you going to do, Hector, when you grow up? I'm going to kill my daddy. With a dull razor blade. I got out of the house, was very young. Now when I think back, you know, I knew I was coming here since I was 8 years old. I had seen pictures of you in the magazines, in American magazines, and I adored you. I want to go to America. Look at those kids. They have kitchens. They have bathrooms. They have toasters. Wow. A toaster. What an incredible thing, you know. So when I was 12 years old, I got into sports, and I would come home, drop the books, and go to the gym, you know, and I play basketball. My second dream as a child was to be the first white globetrotter, you know what I mean? I just love basketball, but I was too short, and I didn't jump too high, so I was not that good. But I loved it anyway, and that saved me, you know. And then when I was 18 years old, I left the house. Not when I think in hindsight, I was saving myself. When I was 24, I saved enough money and I came to America. Oh, by the way, I came here legally, okay? So don't get any funny ideas. If you don't like my pitch, you cannot call immigration. It's too late. I've been an American citizen for 35 years. And I went to New York and I got into advertising, you know, and I worked really, really hard, but I couldn't understand a single word the way you guys spoke, especially in New York, because my English, my teacher was English in Argentina. He said, hello, Hector, no, no, 20, 40, ooh, really? And nobody talks like that in New York, you know? So I couldn't understand a damn thing. But I worked really, really hard. And since I didn't have any friends, I'm an isolator, I saved a lot of money and I went to Europe for 4 months. In 1961, a person from Argentina, in order to go to Europe, had to be a millionaire. It was something out of your reach. And I went there and I visited Europe, 9 countries, and I visited every single museum in Rome and in France, in Spain, and it just changed me, you know. I lost the little hick boy from the little town in Argentina, and I became more of an American. I gave myself like a little bit of culture. And when I came back, I went back to advertising, and I wanted to socialize. I wanted to socialize, you know. And I didn't know, if you think I have an accent now, you should have heard me, you know. How many is that? 45 years ago. I went to this movie with this little girl, young lady, you know, to see a movie with Rock Hudson and Gina LaBrigida. And all of a sudden I realized Gina had an accent. And I said to my young date, the date, I said, boy, Gina has thick accent. She said, oh, no, 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 it's very charming, just like yours. I have accent? Yes, and it's adorable. I immediately hated her. You know, I go home and the next day I bought a tape recorder. And caca, 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 dear, I have an accent. I sounded like Frito Bandido, you know what I mean? Now I sounded like my parents in Argentina. They were foreigners, they had accents, you know. So they told me in order to socialize, I have to go to a bar. Remember, I was an athlete in Argentina. There were no bars you had to go to in my little town in Argentina. I said, you have to go to a bar to socialize. So I'm very anal. I like to do everything very properly. Oh, by the way, another dream of mine is I wanted to be a wasp when I came here. You know, I wanted to be blonde, you know, with blue eyes. And I used to dress with Brooks Brothers suits, you know, button-down shirt, striped tie. But I had this huge afro and this huge black mustache coming down like here, right? No matter how I dressed, I always looked like a Mexican yuppie, you know what I mean? I just didn't make it, you know. So I got a nice haircut, you know. I dressed in a three-piece suit, and I practiced how to order a drink. Remember, I never been to a bar. So I wanted to be sophisticated. So I looked in the bar, in the mirror, and I go, excuse me, whiskey, you know. Excuse me, whiskey, you know. And I practiced for an hour. So I walk into this bar on Madison Avenue in 54th, very sophisticated area of New York. And I looked inside. It was like 10, 15 guys, you know, dark suits, dark ties, crew cut. I thought there were a bunch of Mormons. See, because the only Americans I knew in my little towns were the Mormon missionaries. They used to come there to try to change us from unhappy little Catholics to unhappy little Mormons. And they were very nice, and they played great basketball, you know. But they all had crew cuts. Nobody in Argentina has a crew cut, you know. So the bartender comes over, this tall blonde guy, and goes, blu-blu-blu-blu-blu-blu-blu. It's English to us. When you don't know, it's like, you know, Spanish to you. It's gibberish. But I was prepared. I said, whiskey, you know. And he looked at me and he goes, blu-blu-blu-blu. And I kept saying, whiskey, you know. Now in hindsight, I realized he was asking me what kind of whiskey, on the rocks, with soda. I don't know, caca. So I kept saying, whiskey. He got pissed. So he grabbed this funny bottle with a beak, right, and a shot glass. I never seen a shot glass in my entire life. So he poured this piss-like substance inside the little glass, right? And put it in front of me. And I look at the little glass. Why does he give me such a little glass? I looked around, and all the Mormons had tall glasses, you know. Is it because I'm short? Oh. Or maybe he's punishing me because I'm not a Mormon, right? So I didn't care. I tried to act macho, right? So I picked up the little glass, and I swallowed the whole thing in one take. Oh, it was awful. It came out of my ears, my nose, my eyes. I was coughing, and this guy standing next to me, who looked like Gregory Peck in To Kill a Mockingbird, right? He says, ¿Por qué no prueba Cuba Libre in Spanish? Why don't you try Cuba Libre? Ah, Spanish, easy to pronounce. Cuba Libre, por favor, Cuba Libre, Cuba Libre. Rum and Coke. I'm addicted to sugar. I loved it. From then on, I drank everything with Coke. Scotch and Coke. Vodka and Coke. And finally, I graduated to my drink of choice, sangria and Coke. And don't move. You know, you didn't try it. You know, you don't know nothing. I love any drink that had an umbrella in it, I absolutely loved. You know what I mean? I just love sweet drinks. And I basically did not like drinking. I drank because I didn't like anything about myself. And when I drank, I was tall, I was good looking, I spoke perfect English. I was a loud asshole, that's what I was. And I got punched a lot, you know what I mean, and thrown out of places. So, but I drank because, you know, I didn't like, you know, once I read that Leonardo da Vinci, who was a genius, he said, the perfectly proportioned man is 7 times the size of his head. He was a genius. So I measure my head. This is extra large, okay? According to that, I am supposed to be 7 feet 2 inches tall. So every time I looked in the mirror, I saw this little midget with this huge head. I had an afro in those days. It was even bigger, you know what I mean? See my nose? It looks like a bell pepper, right? I had a nose job. I'm the only person I know who looks exactly the same before and after. It's not funny, you know? I went home and my mother didn't realize I had a nose job. I was so pissed. And that's why I drank, you know what I mean? I daydream about, you know, when I'm drinking, I become this person, that person. And I really deteriorated real fast. I began crawling around my apartment drunk and puking and asking God to kill me because I know I'm a piece of garbage. And I had my first suicide attempt. Don't ask me why. I don't know why. Maybe the doorman didn't say good morning to me. And I'm very sensitive. You don't say good morning to me, I'll kill myself. I'll teach you a lesson. And they had to pump my stomach, and they made me see a shrink. And I saw many, many shrinks. And they were all good, but they couldn't help me because I never told them the truth. And one day I got a moment of clarity. I know what's going to help me. Because, you see, I have fulfilled the American dream. I had the furniture from Bloomingdale's, the suits from Brooks Brothers. They had a wonderful little apartment with a beautiful view of Manhattan. And I still felt like a piece of garbage, and I didn't know why. You told me why when I came here. You told me I was looking for a material solution to a spiritual problem. And you told me nothing that I see with my eyes can fix my insides. Not the relationship, not the car, not the bank account, not the house, not the money. None of those things. For us, alcoholics, the solution is on page 45. The main object of this book is to help you find a power greater than yourself that will solve your problem. That's what the solution is for me. I did not know. And I was really, really very unhappy. And I know it's going to help me if I become an actor. And I was going to be the greatest actor who ever lived. I was going to do Richard III in London better than Laurence Olivier. That's kind of difficult when you can't speak English, you know. And I got into this play, and this play went to Broadway, and we won all the awards. Best play of the year, we won the Tony, which is equivalent to the Oscar. In the movies, the Tony is the equivalent in the theater. And I still felt like a piece of garbage. And I used to get drunk, and I came to I would wake up at 1 o'clock in the afternoon, 2 o'clock in the afternoon. And one day I came to about 2 o'clock in the afternoon. I had urinated on myself in this beautiful apartment, my beautiful clothes. I was all wet, and I had a moment of clarity. We all do. I realized what my problem was. My problem is New York. This is a very unfriendly, hostile place. You know, this is horrible. I have to move to a more loving, caring, nurturing place. So I moved to Hollywood. And you know, I was always an isolator. I was always alone, because if you get to know me, you know I'm a piece of garbage, right? But when I went to LA, it got worse. In New York, you go down the elevator, you open the doors, you know, and it's 10,000 people, right? They're all ready to mug you, but at least they're there, right? In LA, to get mugged, you need a car. You know what I mean? Everything is far away. And I got into television, and I did a lot on this. When was it? The 70s and the 80s. I did a lot of guest starring roles in television. And I was always playing bad guy. I was killing people, molesting women, selling children, smuggling dope. You know what I mean? I was always handcuffed. You know, I've been handcuffed on TV more times than the Menendez brothers. Okay? Always bad guys. And I was so sick and tired of it. And suddenly, I got a part. It was, remember the Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid, I think it was. The sequel to that, it was a movie for television called The Sundance Woman with Catherine Ross. Remember The Graduate? She's the girl in The Graduate, right? And I'm going to play a good guy. I'm going to save the girl. I'm so happy. And I auditioned. I got the part, you know. Then they called me home. The director said, "We forgot to ask you, Hector. Can you ride a horse?" Can I ride a horse? I'm a gaucho from Argentina. I was born on a horse. I lied. So we get to Tucson, right? We do all the interiors. Now we're going to do the exteriors. We're going to ride around the jail and save Catherine Ross. So we're going to rehearse. I hate horses to begin with, right? So they put me on top of that stupid animal. Now, if it's a horse, this is you. If you ride properly, it's like this. Nice. When I did it, it was like this. The director didn't think it was funny. He had a heart attack. Says, "Hector, we ask you, this man on the horse like one unit. He really chewed me out and made me practice for 4 hours. After 4 hours, I couldn't get off the horse. When I got off the horse, I could not get my legs together. I walked like this. And my ass was a huge blister. I couldn't sit. So I went to my hotel, got some sangria and Coca-Cola, and got really pissing drunk. And the next day I got on the set and said, "Excuse me, sir, I cannot do the take. You know, my ass is a huge blister." He says, "Hector, we don't give a shit. See behind you is 200 extras on horses. We cannot hire them tomorrow." Okay? So what they did is they put a wet towel from the hotel on top of this, what do you call that thing? The saddle, right? And this Marlboro guy, the Wranglers, sat me on top of the saddle, right on top of the horse. So here I'm playing this heavy-duty macho bandito, right? Mexican, really tough. Bullets across my chest, huge mustache, the hat, the guns, you know. And I'm sitting on wet towels, you know what I mean? It's very demeaning. So now they give me the gun. It says, "Hector, don't cock the gun until you're galloping." Right? Because those blanks are very, very dangerous. So cock the gun after you gallop in and shoot only in the air, right? Because I'm surrounded by other people. So the six principals are lined up. We're going to take off. The 200 Mexican horse are going to come behind us. So I have a hangover, right? My Wrangler is standing right there holding the reins. When they say actual, he goes like this. Bam! And so I'm shaking. So I'm going to cock the gun. I want to get at least one shot. So I cock the gun, and I'm holding the gun like this because I'm nervous, and the horse goes, boom. Oh, my God, I shot the Wrangler in the ass. Oh, he didn't think it was funny. So we do the take, right? Retake. Now, he's holding the horse like this now, right? I'm an alcoholic, but I'm not stupid. I cocked the gun again, but I put it next to my leg. And the horse goes, boom. Oh, my God, I shot my leg. My costume is in flames. I'm an alcoholic. I have to save Catherine Ross. So we start galloping, right? And the flames start coming up, right? By the end of the take, it was like a torch on top of the horse. They went crazy, you know what I mean? They threw me on the floors with the blankets, you know what I mean? They put the fire out, and they sent me to the hospital to L.A. And I had to be in the hospital for a month. I had two operations. One to remove the infection because it got infected. You know, it was about this big, right on my calf. Still have the scar. And another one for a skin graft. While I was in the hospital, my agent didn't send me flowers. And I'm very sensitive. I just told you, right? You don't send me flowers, I'll kill myself. I'll teach you a lesson. So I asked my friend Irene to bring in the pills. By the way, I never did pills. I only have 40 pills in case I wanted to kill myself. That's it. You know, actually, I'm lying. Once somebody in the gym gave me one of those things, it's called Black Beauties. A lot of junkies here. He said, Hector, if you take this, you're going to have a lot of energy. I took it. Did I have energy? I cleaned my apartment up and down twice in one day, and I kept making plans for the rest of my life. You know, I couldn't stop. The only problem is I couldn't close my mouth. It was like this. Never again. Give me sangria and cocoa. Give me death. You know what I mean? So Irene brings me the pills, and I take the pills, 30, 40 pills, and that was my last suicide attempt. I was in coma for 3 days. I had 2 cardiac arrests. They had to revive me twice. I was dead twice, and they had to revive me twice. I basically was dead for 3 days. You know, and when I came to, I was tied up to the gurney because I kept fighting. When I had the DTs, I had 15 tubes this way, that way, this way, this way. You know, my crotch was all full of blisters because I kept urinating on myself. I had been dead for 3 days, and I had everything. I had a new Mercedes. I had the most beautiful wardrobe you ever seen, a gorgeous apartment. I had enough money in the bank to live a whole year without working. The only thing I didn't have was Hector. I didn't know who I was. One of you described me from the podium once. He said about himself, I was a huge ball of fear covered with a little human skin. That was me. I was just a frightened little man. And see, the book says that fear is like a thief because it robs us of our lives. Remember the fourth, what they had the chart for the fourth step? The last column is always fear, 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 fear. And I had a whole life based on fear. I'm not tall enough. I'm not good enough. I'm not intelligent enough. I will never accomplish enough. Fear, fear, fear. My shrink sent me to AA. Hector, an alcoholic. Go to AA. I said, are you sure, Michael? Yes, you are. Go. And I've been sober 28 years, and I do now the same things I did 28 years ago when I came to AA. I go to meetings. I have a sponsor. I sponsor about 8, 10 people. I have 3 commitments. I pray, I meditate, and I work the steps. And I don't do that because I'm good or spiritual. I do that because I don't want to die. And when you are long-time sobriety, when you have long-time sobriety, you see a lot of people with long-time sobriety dead because they forget to give the number one priority to the program. Some people say, AA is my life. No, it's not. AA is not my life. AA is my way of life. And I teach a guy I sponsor, it's okay to give 10% of your life to AA. Make sure it's the first 10%. That's it. See, my program comes before everything else. Relationship, family, work, house, friends, money, AA first. It's not a debatable issue. I have the things I have to do, and I do them. And it makes me feel good. You know, that's what I do it. At the beginning, I had a great deal of trouble with, I want to talk a little bit about the steps, because to me, this is the most important part of my pitch, you know. By the way, welcome to the newcomers. Welcome to the newcomers. I give thanks to God for sending you here. By the way, newcomers, stay with us. Nobody wants you anyway. No. Stay with us and let us love you until you learn how to love yourself. We just love you. We just love you. We care for you. We know who you are, you know, and we'll be with you for the rest of your life if you allow us to. And we don't want anything from you. We want you to discover who you really are, because that's what my friend Leonard, when he taught me the steps, is the purpose of the steps is to find out who you are. The greatest journey of a man's life is the discovery of his own soul, and I did not know that. I came to believe in AA that there are two Hectors. The one Hector, the Hector built, faced on fear, and the one Hector that God created based on love, which is whole, complete, needing nothing. And that's the journey. And it's an inner journey. It has nothing to do with the material world. Because I was taught here that everything I came looking for, I came with. Love is inside of me. Success is inside of me. Kindness is inside of me. Vision is inside of me. Intelligence. Why is that? Because the book says, I'm a child of God. He is the Father. We are His children. If God created me, that means that God's DNA is inside of me, percolating at all times. That's my essence. I've been created by the Most High. This is what the book says. We're children of God. So my task with the steps is to really learn how to harness what we call in AA God's grace. And I didn't know what God's grace was. And you taught me. God's grace is an unmerited gift. And God loves me not because I'm good, because He is good. And God's grace is inside of all of us. So that's the journey of the 12 steps, to get rid of all the garbage and get in touch with this divinity which is inside of all of us. When I came here, you know, I came from a Catholic background, and I'm not putting down Catholicism. Catholic, yes. Catholic is a religion, right? Yes. I'm getting senile a little bit. So I'm a Catholic, and my God was not a loving God. My God looked like Charlton Heston, and He behaved like Leona Hemsley. You know what I mean? This was not a loving God. So I had to find a God that really, really loved me and that I could love and feel comfortable with. And I found this concept about God, and this applies only to me. By the way, everything I say applies only to me. And this man, Joel Goldsmith, says, regardless of how high your concept of God is, it is wrong. Because it's still a concept. Eventually, you have to lose all concepts and reach the consciousness, like conscious contact, that God is. And then leave the subject alone, because with the mind, you're never going to understand what God is. How can I understand a spiritual entity that takes care of 6 billion people at the same time, when theologians and great religious authorities have not been able to define it in 2,000 years? And the book says the same thing. It says, God is everything or else is nothing. God is everything or else is nothing. You know. And also on page 46, it says, even though it was impossible for any of us to fully define or comprehend that power which we call God. And it is not my job to find God, it's my job to seek God. And I was told by my sponsors, better than to really find God is to see it in everybody and everything. See the face of God in everybody you meet. And Hector, be a presence, a healing presence, not a judging presence. So now I have this higher power that I believe I feel comfortable with. You know, I have to work the steps. And I found a few things. You know, it took me like 14 years to discover what the steps are for. You know, people say, work the steps and achieve sobriety. Absolutely. But for me, just for me, not for you. For me, the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous are spiritual tools to develop a conscious contact with God. And if I do that, the obsession will be removed. He says so on the 12 and 12, page 32. The fact was we really had not clean house, so that the grace of God could enter us and expel the obsession. Therefore, we remain self-deceived and so incapable of receiving enough grace to restore us to sanity. So that's what I had to do. Clean up this. Clean up the channel so God can enter into my insides. Okay, I did not know that. You see, I'm on myself, I'm nothing, the book says. I'm just a channel through which God can shine. God could and would. It doesn't say Hector could and would. That's in my sponsor, good and would. God could and would, and he was sought. So the first step is I have a problem. My problem, according to page 45, I think, is powerlessness. The second step is I need a solution. That solution is God. God, you understand him. I don't understand God, but I love God, and I believe in God, and I try to seek God and try to do what I think God wants from me, is to be kind, loving, and helpful. So the step three says I have to turn my will and my life over to the care of God. I did not know what my will was or my life. You taught me. Charlie and Joe taught me. My will is my thoughts. Somebody said 2,000 years ago, as a man thinketh, so is he. Thoughts are things. Think about it. The chair you're sitting on, this building, your hat, your blouse, your shoes, your watch. Everything started with a thought that was taken to a final fruition. What a man thinketh, so is he. The big book says the same thing, page 23. The main problem with the alcoholic centered in his mind rather than in his body. So my will is my thought. And what is my life? I did not know. You taught me here. My life is my action, the sum total of my actions. It's like Emerson said, a man is not judged by what he does, but how he dresses, how much money he has. He's judged by his action. Emerson said, your action speaks so loud, I cannot hear what you're saying. That's why the book says action, action, and more action. It doesn't say talking, 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 and more talking. Action, action, and more action. So how do I turn my will and my life over to the care of God? By working the rest of the steps. I have to do 4 and 5. 4 and 5 is a relationship with myself. The book says I'm blocked from the sunshine of the Spirit. What are my blockages? My character defects. God cannot use me if I'm full of hate, resentment, lies, anger. So this has been cleansed. I had to find out what my character defects. Then I go home. I do this with my sponsor. I tell my sponsor my character defects. I ask, show it to God and myself. So I have a list of all the character defects, right? Then I go home, and I take the book from the shelves, like it says, and for an hour, I check the preceding steps to see if I forgot anything. Now my sponsor I made a list of the main character defects from my inventory. So next to that list, let's say if I hate, one of my character defects is hate. What would be the opposite? Love. If I'm stingy, the spiritual principle would be generosity. So I have two lists now. My character defects and the spiritual principles I'm supposed to replace them with. So I ask God to please remove this and help me, please, dear God, to walk in the direction of these principles, which is what represents you. And I do 7. And then I do 8 and 9. 4 and 5 is a relationship with myself. 8 and 9 is my relationship with the world, with the universe. I had to make amends to all of you for all the garbage I did so I can walk just in peace, without shame. And I can become this channel that God can use. Or like the book says, the purpose of the program is to be of maximum use to God and those about us. And then comes 9, I do the amends, and then comes 10. You know, when we were wrong, it doesn't say when they were wrong. Did you notice that the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous doesn't have a chapter about them? The 12th step is to work on Hector and allow God, and I don't remove my character defects. God could and would. I have to surrender myself to God. And somebody says surrendering to yourself to God is not an admission of defeat. It's joining the winning side. And then comes prayer and meditation in step 12. My friend Harvey says, prayer, what is how he says it? Prayer, I love this. Now, prayer is when we talk to God. And when we hear the voice of God talking back to you, it's called schizophrenia. I love that. Anyway, prayer. And the book says, pray only for God's will. Because, see, I don't know what's good for me. I thought having the Mercedes was good for me, having the suits, being on television. I even became a member of the Oscars. All that didn't serve me for nothing. I was dead for 3 days. So obviously, I don't know what's good for me. Pray only for God's will and the power to carry that out. And after I pray, I meditate. And prayer is not a supplication, it's not a begging, it's not a deal making. If I do such and such, God, can you give me a new car? Prayer is really a dialogue with God to align myself with the will of God. And prayer doesn't do anything to the mind of God. It does something to the mind of the person praying. That's what I have to pray. And then I meditate. And this is, I go to silence. And there are many ways of meditation, and not one is good for everybody. And I was thinking, why is it that the first 11 steps end up in silence? Prayer and meditation, silence. And I thought, because silence is the language of God. Be still and know that I am God. He doesn't say run around in your Mercedes, listening to music, talking on the phone, eating a sandwich, and know that I am God, right? Be still. And somebody said the highest form of prayer is silence. And that's what I think, that's what I meditate every morning. And then comes 12. 12 is service. The book says faith without works is dead. And it says it 3 times. I can sound like Mother Teresa from the podium, but if I'm not helping somebody, it's not good for anything. I was taught here that the only healing love is the love I give to you. It's wonderful that you love me, but it's infinitely much more important that I love you. That's why the book says, when everything else fails, it doesn't say go out and buy another cashmere sweater, does it? When everything else fails, go and find the newcomer to help, to love, to care for. And that's, Khalil Gibran said, when we die, the only thing we take with us is what we had given away. And the most important thing we can give away is the gift of oneself. Step 12. See, when I'm sick in bed, I don't want you to come and say, you know, I bought you this. No, I want you to hold my hand and say, I love you, Hector. It's going to be okay. And that's love. And that's step 12. I'm going to talk now about making amends because I talked to you how I felt about my parents. And I hated my parents. And I was ashamed of them. They were illiterate. They had funny accents. They dressed badly. They were not fashionable, you know. And the book says resentment is number one killer. And it doesn't exempt parents. Isn't it funny? You know, if a newcomer walks through that door, you know, he says, well, I just came out of jail. I killed 2 people and I robbed 5 banks and I was in jail for 30 years. I just came out. What do we say? Welcome. You're one of us. Do you want some cookie and coffee? Later on, we'll take you out to dinner. Instant forgiveness. Not with our parents. They had to be perfect. Are we perfect? I don't know about you, but I'm not. And when I went to do the 8th and 9th, I didn't want justice. I wanted those people to forgive me. And I had to forgive them, not for them, for me. Because somebody said having a resentment against anybody is like drinking poison and expecting the other person to die. This has to be cleansed. Resentment is the number one killer, the book says. It doesn't say parents are exempted. So I looked at it. Yes, my mother chained me a few times and beat me up a few times. That was maybe 15% of the equation. She was an illiterate woman. Both my parents were illiterate. But she put me through 12 years of school. And I'm not condoning what she did wrong. But you know something? In sobriety, I have done a lot of things wrong that I had to make amends for in sobriety. Right? So I looked at the whole picture. 15% wrong. But she, an illiterate woman, sent me to 12 years school. My father wanted me to be a delivery boy. He says, no, my son is going to study. She worked at two jobs. There's no welfare in Argentina. Now there is, but 50 years ago there wasn't. And she worked at two jobs, 5 o'clock in the morning to 11 o'clock at night, every single day of the year. So she could really send me to school. And I always had food and clothes. She made the clothes. And I remember when I was 5 years old, we didn't have money for a Christmas tree. So she took a broomstick, some wire, and some crepe paper, green crepe paper, and she made a Christmas tree. 4 branches, 5 branches, 6 branches. She went out with a quarter and bought 4 Christmas balls and a point. But guess what? I had my Christmas tree. And every year she made it a little bigger and she made the ornaments. When I was 12 years old, it is a fashion, a custom in Argentina to give the boy, male boy, a bicycle. Working at two jobs every single day of the year, she bought me the best bicycle in the entire neighborhood, El Legnano, imported from Italy. See, she was doing the best she could with the tools she had. See, most of us don't get it at home. We had the opportunity to go to school, and the teachers taught us something. She never went to school. You know, she was doing the best she could with the tools she had. So when I was about 3 years sober, I sent her a ticket so she could come to my home. I didn't have my house yet, but my apartment in L.A. to come and visit L.A. She had never been on a plane before. And when she landed and came to my apartment, she had a 12-foot tall, real Christmas tree decorated in her favorite colors, pink and red. And she had 33 presents underneath the Christmas tree. We overdo things in AA. And I told my mom how much I loved her. And I thanked her for sending me to the gym, for buying me the shoes, for buying me the clothes and the books. Never did I mention what she did wrong. We don't do that in AA. We do this part of the line, this side of the line. We never talk. And I remember I brought her back one more time, about 3 or 4 years later, with my sister Olga. We had a ball. And I overheard this conversation between my sister Olga and my mom. My mom said to Olga, "Olga, you know what I wish for all the mothers of the world?" And Olga said, "What?" "That all of them could have a son like my Hector." And that relationship was healed. That was healed. She still drove me crazy when I visited her. You know what I mean? Mothers are supposed to do that. You know, but I was healed. I didn't have no rancor. I have no hate. And I was able to accept her exactly as she was. You know, she died when she was 91. And I had been a good son because for 20 years, every month, I send a check to Argentina. So my conscience was clean. That was clean. With my father, it was a little more different. You know, I really hated him because I was afraid of him. I was afraid. Somebody said, we operate under two emotions, love and fear. Love is God. Fear is the absence of God, you know? And when I was about 14 years sober, I got a letter from Syria. And I moved back there, and he had a new wife and a new child. And he said, "Hi, son, I haven't heard from you." Of course he hadn't. I didn't know where he was. And I just wrote to you just to say hello. I wanted to see how you're doing. Oh, and one more thing, you know, I had to pay some taxes, so can you send me some money? Son of a bitch, you write to me after 14 years because you need money? You know, and then he continued. Oh, one more thing. My family here says if nobody talks to me from the other side of the ocean, I must have done something wrong. If I did, I apologize. Did you do something wrong? And I began writing back. And I began listing everything he did wrong. And now I'm in AA and I don't lie. And this is a big list. 3 or 4 pages, you know, all the things that he had done wrong, right? And this is the truth. Then I made a mistake. Newcomers never do this, okay? I asked an old timer what to do. And she said, "Hector, would you rather be right? Would you rather be at peace?" I'd rather be right. I waited 50 years for this shit. You know what I mean? But I'm brainwashed. All of us are brainwashed in AA. You know what I mean? So I send a nice letter, you know. I didn't send the money, but I sent the letter. And it was not good enough. It was not good enough. So I went back to a shrink who sent me to AA 28 years ago. And after 2 sessions, I said, "Hector, you have to go to Syria and meet your father. You don't know your father." What? Syria? Syria's full of Syrians. You know what I mean? They all look like my father. I don't want to go there. But, you know, I'm brainwashed. And I called my dad, and he sounded senile on the phone. I said, I'll be there. And I landed in Damascus. And this giant that used to beat me up, that I was so afraid of, is this little man about this tall, bald-headed, wispy white hair, baggy pants, running towards me, crying, and he embraces me, and he starts sobbing. And I start sobbing. Who is this man? I don't know my dad. And we're sobbing. His family are sobbing behind him. People are watching us are sobbing. And then he grabs me by the hand like a 5-year-old and puts me in a taxi and takes me to his village where he lives, this very, 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 very poor village. And he told me his story. His father was about 15, 16 years old. His mother was 15 years old. They had him. Neither one of them went to school. He never went to school. And he moved to Argentina and met my crazy mother. How is he going to know to be a loving, caring, nurturing father? Love is like any other subject. Unless somebody showed it to you, expressed it to you, you cannot give it to somebody else. You know? He didn't know, but he really, really loved me. I just did not love him. See, I don't want an illiterate person from Syria to be my father. I want Nelson Rockefeller. No, 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 Hector. This is your dad. This is the one you have to love. He loved me so much. He made me dress in a 3-piece suit in this very poor, poor, poor village. His house was the only one with a bathroom. He sat me in the living room, put steak in front of me, which is very expensive in Syria, and invited all the villagers from the village to say hello to my son Hector from America. And they all had to shake my hand and render honor to me. A blind person, a beggar without shoes, walked into the room, a beggar, and they guided his hand to touch my face, so that he too may know what Brahim's son looked like. That's how much he loved me. I spent 8 days with him. And we talked. And we talked. And I filmed him. And I photographed him. When I came back, when I was at the, Damascus Airport, we were saying goodbye, and we're both sobbing. Not crying, but sobbing. I knew I was not going to see him ever again. And I said, Daddy, I love you very, very much, and I'm so proud that you're my daddy. And he grabbed my face and kissed me all over. And he said, I'm 10 times more proud that you're my son. I'm so proud of you. I'm so proud of what you've done with your life. And this visit to my little village is the most beautiful present anybody could have given me. No money in the world could make me happier. And I left. When I came back to America, something very subtle had changed. Very subtled. See, I always looked like a man, I acted like a man, I accomplished like a man, I sounded like a man, but inside of myself, I was a 12-year-old kid, emotionally, because being like a man was being like my daddy, and I hated my daddy. And now when I think about my dad, I smile. The poor little illiterate little peasant did the best he could with the tools he had. And now I know what a real man is, or a real woman. Has nothing to do with what we drive, how we dress, how much money we make, nothing to do with that. A real man is somebody who is at peace with himself. Because when I'm at peace with myself, I have connected with that divinity which is inside of me by working the steps, by having commitments, by talking to my sponsor. I'm at peace. I can do what the book says, to be of maximum use to God and those about us. It is an inner journey. Newcomers, everything you came here looking for, you brought it with you. It's all inside of you. You know what we're going to do with you? We're going to teach you how to harness it, how to use it. We love you. God loves you, and God bless you.